tonight on Arena. Selena Cartmell on the path ahead for Dublin's Gate Theatre, and Pat Carty on U2's ongoing YouTube offerings. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Tomorrow sees U2 continue their virtual tour on YouTube with the release of Live at Red Rocks from 1983, following on from last week's broadcast of U2 Go Home, live from Slane Castle in 2001. Over the next few weeks, the band will broadcast Pop Mart, live from Mexico City, and their emotionally charged 2015 show from Paris shortly after the terrorist attacks in that city. I'm joined now by U2 aficionado Pat Carty, who has seen every tour since 1987. So the credentials, Pat, are fairly sound here.
I heard a rumour today, Sean, that you have not seen them at all.
Not live, but I've listened to a lot of them.
I don't know what you've been doing with your time over the last 33
years. Well, clearly you've been doing nothing else with your time but going to U2 tours.
Nothing else. I mean, I follow them around. I sleep outside Bono's house most of the time as well.
So tell me, everybody talks about U2 and the live performance and how essential that is to actually what the band do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously they've made some classic records. I could name four at least off the top of my head. But to see them live, and in the instance of the Slane show that you mentioned there, to see them live in Ireland is a pretty amazing experience. That no matter how many shows or how many other people that you've seen, there is something special about it. Now, I know it's a national pastime to have a go at them and everything, but that's where they really shine.
Yeah, well, that Slane Castle concert from 2001, I mean, they always talk, I think, they themselves, and that's not surprising that they put that out on St. Patrick's Day last week. That was so emotionally charged. You were there yourself. Could you sense the emotion in the crowd? Hadn't there been the World Cup qualifier? We'd just beaten Holland in the World Cup qualifiers as well that day. So there was national hysteria, I'm sure, down in Slane.
Well, there's another thing as well. I mean, that for very rare occurrence down in Slane, there was two shows that year because there was such a demand for tickets. So they played the week before, which was, I think, only a day or two after Bono's father's funeral.
Yeah.
And then the one that was recorded then was on the 1st of September, as you say. Now, just from a personal point of view, my own father had died only recently as well. So I was wide open to have a bit of a brown rice and lentils experience, if you know what I mean, at that concert. And I had a few Chardonnays going in as well, of course, so that didn't hurt. And it was an amazing concert. I mean, I think of all the concerts I've seen, it might be the best thing I've ever seen by anybody.
And did you watch it again?
Oh, I have watched it several times.
On St. Patrick's Day.
Well, even before that, I bought the DVD, and sometimes when there's a bottle open at home, I might put it on sometimes, and it does really capture what happened on that. Now, as you say, I don't know an awful lot about soccer, as you can probably tell straight away, but we were watching that game in the crowd. They put it on the screen. So we were watching that before that, and then, of course, McAteer gets the goal and Ireland wins. So, you know, if people weren't in a great mood before that, they were certainly ready for it after that.
Yeah, well, certainly from the concerts that I've watched at different points along the way, there is something that they do on stage that is very different from what other bands do. I'll come back to Slane before the end of this, but let's talk about tomorrow and Live at the Red Rocks from 1983. That will be released. Again, all of these are free on YouTube now, it has to be said. So you can just go on and watch them. There's no charge for getting in there. You say this is the kind of the end of U2 Mark I, this concert. And how important was that concert in establishing them in America?
Yeah, I think you have to remember that it was recorded in 83, and I think maybe it didn't come out till the following year. But we're talking about the time when MTV ruled the roost in America. And U2 had made, you know, plenty of inroads already, but they weren't where they were going to be. But Paul McGuinness, their manager at the time, had a background in film, so he knew that the effect that this could have of getting their live show out there. And a lot of the clips from this show went on heavy rotation on MTV, and it really did break them in America. I mean, people talk about Live Aid, but they'd already, I think, played Madison Square Garden before that, so they were a big deal even then. And Under Blood Red Sky is the main reason why, I think.
Of course, it contains a very famous song and a very famous introduction. Let's just listen to that famous introduction. Remember 1983, remember where Ireland, and in particular Northern Ireland, was at in the 1970s and 80s. This is 1983 and this is Bono.
There's been a lot of talk about this next song. Maybe too much talk. This song is not a rebel song. This song is Sunday, Bloody Sunday.
Sunday, Bloody Sunday, and that has performed by U2 live at the Red Rocks in Denver, Colorado. And that full concert will be available live, or will be available on YouTube from tomorrow, Thursday, the 25th of March. 1983 in Denver, Colorado, and the problems... You would think this would be an Irish problem. They had problems with the weather.
They did, yeah, yeah. I mean, you can't see, first of all, Sean, because you can't see me in the other studio, but I'm after putting a hole in the desk with the eardrum into that. That's just fantastic. But, yeah, the weather, as you say, they'd put a lot of their own money into this, you know, invested in with the record company as well. So it was a lot riding on it. And, on, you know, they had a sellout tour of similar-sized venues, and this place had sold out, Red Rocks in Colorado, and they get there on the day, and there's flood warnings, there's torrential rain. And a lot of people told them, listen, it can't go ahead. And I think they decided at 1 o'clock on the day of the show itself for it to go ahead. And a lot of the crew didn't want to do it, a lot of the local crew. So McGuinness had to make Paul McGuinness had to make a quite famous Errol Flynn, Robin Hood kind of speech down underneath the stage. And, you know, who's with me, that kind of thing. That there was so much riding on this. But it kind of, and the place was half full, but, you know, luckily because of the mist of the rain, you can't really see that in the video. And... I mean, it adds to it because a lot of it is torch lit and you have the mist and things like that and the rain, and you can see the rain falling on the crowd. So again, you know, it just worked out for them.
Yeah, and the song Sunday, Bloody Sunday, and the controversy around the lyrics there and the political content, where does that stand in 2021?
Well, if people remember later on, Rattling Home, that there was a very emotional scene in that where Bono, you know, made a speech before, as he tends to do, and they still play that. I mean, even on the last tour where I saw them a few times, they played that, but they've rearranged it again. I mean, despite and because of the lyrics, I mean, it's just a great rock and roll song. And in a live context, I mean, you know, you might get fired up and your emotions and all that, but you're jumping up and down.
Next Thursday then, April the 1st, Pop Mart Live from Mexico City will be available. Mm-hmm. We have to talk about what the boys are wearing, I think, here, don't we?
You have to. Absolutely. I mean, I can remember this. They played in Lansdowne. I think it used to be still called Lansdowne at that stage in 1987.
Oh, it probably was then. I'm not sure about
they played
when that changed.
Two dates on that tour. One, the night that Princess Diana died, if I remember rightly. Anyway, Bono comes out. He's got bubble trousers and a muscle T-shirt, and he's got a hoodie on, and he comes out into the crowd like a boxer. The Edge seems to have decided he's joining the Village People with the hat and the mustache cowboy outfit. Adam Clayton, now, I don't know what was going on there. He had an army helmet on, and, well, actually, I suppose he was thinking decades ahead. He had a surgical mask on for a lot of the show. And, of course, Larry Mullen, who must have a very, very distressed portrait in his attic still, just looked like Larry Mullen. He just looked cool, as he always does.
He
just had the regular Larry Mullen outfit on, T-shirt, jeans, good haircut, good man himself. Nice smell, got his own teeth, fair play.
So he looked cool in your mind at any rate. That gives us a sense, what you're saying there, all the clothes that they were wearing. Obviously, there was always an aesthetic with the tours.
Yeah.
There was a huge visual side to them. That's essential to understanding why these tours are well worth watching in the YouTube versions.
Well, I mean, the Pop Mart one, it pales slightly against what just went before, because, and it's strange maybe that they didn't put one of these up, but the Zoo TV tour after Acton Baby is an incredibly innovative thing. If you think of where they got in 4 or 5 years from Joshua Tree to there, you know, with the screens and everything. And Pop Mart then has this kind of what they call the Kmart aesthetic, whereas it has this huge golden arch, not two, because they didn't want McDonald's lawyers on the phone. A big basket on the top, and then the famous giant lemon that they used to, that spun around. They were inside this now, spun around, and then they come out and do a song. And luckily, this night in Mexico in 1987, it worked. But on another night, say Oslo in Norway, they got stuck in the lemon and the song was playing and all you could see from the crowd apparently was the shadows of the four fellas sitting inside it. And eventually some of the road crew managed to open it back, very Spinal Tap that, but they took it in good humour. But the songs on this, you know, it follows up the pop album, which they said themselves since that they weren't 100% happy with, but it's still a great performance. They're still great songs.
2015, and this is going to be the fourth one. I don't know if it's the final one. Certainly in this batch, it would seem it is. The Innocence and Experience tour, very recent indeed, from 2015. Yeah. Again, Bono live on stage and how Bono introduces tracks, how Bono introduces people is extraordinary.
It is.
Now, we were only a few weeks away from the Bataclan disaster where the American band Eagles of Death were on stage. Mm. 90 people killed on the night in that particular venue. So Bono is on stage in Paris a few weeks later. This is what he says.
These are our brothers, our fellow troubadours. They were robbed of their stage 3 weeks ago, and we would like to offer them ours tonight. Would you welcome the Eagles of Death Metal?
People have the power. What a lyric to be singing 3 weeks after the Bataclan massacre on stage in Paris. And the extraordinary thing there, Pat Carty, in terms of what you two did, they kind of stood back and became the backing band for these guys. It was an extraordinary act of generosity.
Yeah, that's a Patti Smith song. And as you say, yeah, Eagles of Death Metal were playing that night in the Bataclan when the attacks took place. And yeah, they brought them on. This is at the end of the concert. Brought them on. Did people have the power? And then I think they handed over their instruments to the band and walked off.
Wow.
And let them do, they did their own song then to finish Love You All the Time, I think is the name of it. But, I mean, the way that they reacted to that, I mean, you two were in town, you know, around the time of the attacks, they had four shows booked in this Accor Hotels arena. And they got to play two of them and two of them were cancelled. So they rescheduled them and went back. And this is the last show then of that tour. And it was City of Blinding Lights that on the screen, you know, they had the names of all the people who'd passed away and everything. It is a very emotional concert. I mean, there's great links back to
Bono's childhood home and all of that.
Absolutely.
We get pictures of the childhood home put up on screen. So
yeah.
you get a real sense of the innocence and experience that is at the heart of what the tour was saying. You'll be watching all four of them. You've already seen one. You'll be watching tomorrow.
I've seen them all, but sure, I'll watch them again. Yeah,
why not? Yeah. Go Home Live from St. Castle was last week. Live at Red Rocks, 25th of March. 1st of April, Pop Mart Live from Mexico City. And the 10th of April then, the Live in Paris Innocence and Experience. So bring you back to Slane for a brief moment.
Do, I wish you could.
Beautiful day live. What do you remember about this?
Oh, Janie, which it all blends into one. It's just, I remember I'll tell you what I remember. Do you remember those hammers that they had for the match? The blow-up hammers and the tricolours?
Yeah.
And they were all being waved in the air and thrown around the place. And then in New Year's Day, Bono takes the tricolour from the crowd, wraps it around himself, and he says, just for a minute, he says, imagine it's Jason McAteer. Fantastic.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you, Sean. Thought you found a friend to take you out of this place.
There we have Beautiful Day from the live, which is yet the Live at Slane concert that went out last week as part of U2's virtual tour. Next, tomorrow night, Live at Red Rocks from Denver, Colorado, 1983. The following week, Pop Mart Live from Mexico City, 1997. And lastly, Innocence and Experience Live in Paris for Trance 2015. And that is going out on April the 1st, I do believe. The theatre sector in Ireland, along with other performing arts, has been devastated by the coronavirus pandemic. The Gate Theatre, one of the most major historical venues in Dublin, has had its doors closed since March of last year, when, due to the virus, it had to bring down the curtain on Nancy Harris's new play, Our New Girl. Gate director Selena Cartmell has just announced a new programme for 2021, and at the top of the bill is The Visiting Hour, the premiere of a new drama from Frank McGuinness, and that will be streaming towards the end of April. And I'm delighted to be joined by Selena Cartmell this evening. How big a shock was that, close to 10 days before Our New Girl was due to finish, that you actually had to close down, Selena, last year?
Yes, Sean, it was very, very challenging. The 12th of March, I think, will be engraved on all our minds. We had just finished a successful run in New York with Hamlet, with Ruth Negga and a brilliant Irish company. We had Our New Girl on the Gate stage. We were in fourth week of rehearsals for The Little Foxes. We were about to start rehearsals for The Shadow of a Gunman. So it was... It was a shock, but it was a shock, I think, for the entire industry.
Given that when that happened on that night, obviously there was a shock for a couple of weeks. At what point did you realise nothing is going to happen, or I'm deciding that nothing is going to happen in the Gate Theatre in terms of reaching out to audiences for the next whatever amount of time? Here we are 12 months later and we're getting an offering.
I don't think anyone expected when we first closed our doors on the 12th of March, it would be here a year later in this predicament, and still at this point, just being able to launch our first streaming show. I think what has been clear with the Gate business model is that our reliance on box office is so enormous that without it, we actually... our operating costs annually are 1.8 million. Our AC grant, our Arts Council funding is 1.2 million. So normally before any productions are produced, there is a gap there of 600,000. So all productions in many ways, we rely on those productions to bring in our box office.
So when in November then, Selena, November of last year, you expressed a concern that the Gate might not survive. So the 1.2 million that came in the form of a grant for last year was that would keep the backstage or if you like the office area of the theatre. That's all it would keep going. Nothing else.
Indeed. So actually, the operating costs are 1.8 million. So our arts grant is 1.2, and luckily in October we got our stabilisation grant from the Arts Council of another 500K. So between March and October, we were very much fighting for survival, as in we were wondering how we were going to get through the year. And it's a great tribute to the Arts Council to be giving that stabilisation funding to the Gate, so we can be here having this conversation today.
So it was survival money. It was survival money, literally. What I'm wondering then about, you know, obviously you mentioned the productions that were potentially in the offing for last year and then had to be shelved for the reasons you mentioned.
Yeah.
Did you look at all at you know, is there a possibility that we can salvage something here, that we can adjust some of these productions to go online or to do a version of it that we can keep in touch with the audience, with the audience that you clearly need so badly?
Well, audiences and artists, and both audience and artists. But I think we, just to go back to that moment on the 12th of March, we'd already invested 300,000 in productions, in actual funding and investment into those productions we would have to postpone. But without that necessary box office coming in, it would be impossible to have staged or rehearsed or streamed, because obviously with all those things there are costs implicated at that stage with everything as well, Sean.
But I'm wondering, since you had made that investment of so much into the productions at that point in time, was there not, did you go through any kind of ideas of how can we salvage some of this, and let's charge a few quid online for people to watch the performances? If I know people would have wanted to see the Gate online. I know the people would have wanted to see the Gate survive, and they would have been quite happy, I'm sure, to have paid to help towards that survival.
No, absolutely. I mean, we looked at absolutely every possibility that we could look at. We looked at opening the Gate to 50 to 10 people. We looked at rehearsed readings. We looked at every single possibility. But if there is no actual funds of box office guaranteed, it's not possible to start up, because obviously all actors and artists need to be paid. All those things need to actually happen in order to be able to stream it for audio costs, for filming costs.
Sure.
In order to put it out there, that still costs.
Yeah, costs involved in that. So it was finances that forced you into the decision that you were essentially dark since March the 12th. And you'd had, when we think about the success of the just before that period and the way that you had opened up the theatre to new audiences, particularly I'm thinking of, you know, The Great Gatsby, for example, which brought a whole new style and a whole new audience potentially, I think, into the Gate Theatre, and Roddy Doyle's The Snapper, where you had people there, you reduced ticket prices down to €15, I think it was at the time, and people came into the theatre that expressed this reality that they had never been near the Gate Theatre before, and here they were in the theatre now. What about those audiences that you had started to build? Have you kept in touch with those? What have you done to keep that aspect of the work alive?
Well, this is why we're talking today, is that we're back and we're able to do it. What we have been doing very much in the background is making and commissioning work that we can with artists to prepare it for those audiences now that we are through what has been a very dark tunnel for the Gate. But we now see the light, and we have a lot of great and fantastic work that we can bring to those audiences that we have been, you know, building over this time, and then we can now reach out to.
To what extent, Selena, do you think that there are legacy issues here? You've talked about the funding model and the need for box office receipts. Are there legacy issues here that you're trying to deal with and trying to change that are problems for the Gate?
Well, I think, you know, when you've gone into a new organisation, you know, into an organisation that has had, you know, a very long history, I think there's always need for change and progression and different ways of making work and different artists and reaching different audiences. So I think there's always a time that one has to, you know, look at the past, but also think about what the future Gate is going to be as we start rebuilding after what has been a very, very difficult time.
So the plans then that you've announced for 2021, did you try to get any of those back into to happen sooner than now?
Well, I think it's really the crystal ball for everyone to look into and go, when can we reopen to our full capacity audiences? Because obviously when you're looking at social distancing, you're looking at 48 people in the normal Gate setting with 2 meter distance, or double that or a little bit more for 1 meter setting. And I think on a sort of viability piece, it's very tricky unless you're able to open the auditorium to close to full capacity. So most of those productions, and obviously, as you know, Sean, the Gate is very much a classic. So the DNA and the spine of the Gate are classics, coupled with new work. And they're normally classic work is big work and it's expensive work and it's big casts. And some of those shows that we've had programmed last year were very big, like Shadow of a Gunman, Little Foxes. They're big. And the other work we had planned for later in the year also had that epic quality to them. So unless we can really go back to that full capacity box office, it is challenging. However, in the meantime, what we do have are some really, for example, The Visiting Hour, and there's another couple of few shows that we'll be launching over the next few months that I think can offer our audiences and our artists something that is really exciting and invigorating and hopefully surprising and provocative.
Yeah, you've transformed the inside of the building. So during the period when nothing was happening inside, I've only seen pictures. I haven't seen the reality of it. There are no seats. It's a practically unrecognizable theatre.
That's right. We've been working on this for some time. It's called the Gate Creative Studio, and it's open to artists and companies in order to create work, because we knew, as most theatres at the moment, we're still waiting to know regards reopening and social distancing. So we knew in the first few months of this year that the chances of us reopening to a full audience would be greatly reduced. So what we did and decided was we would use this time to incubate work, to develop work, to commission work, to work with some really and collaborate with some really fantastic companies and artists to give them a space to develop work for future gate work, but also work for the industry.
Before before we finish, Selena, tell me about the Frank McGuinness, the upcoming show, which will have Judith Roddy and Stephen Ray. It's a two-hander, and it's been, I suppose, written specifically to deal with the sort of difficulties that you're talking about in terms of social distance, etc., and it will be streamed. What's involved there?
It'll be streamed. It's called The Visiting Hour. It's 60 minutes long, because that is how long you have with your loved one in it, set in a care home. It's a beautiful, poignant, moving meditation, I think, of 60 minutes between a father and daughter. It's, I believe, classical in structure, although contemporary in its themes, and it feels very urgent and relevant now. It is a complete privilege to invite and have Frank McGuinness back at the gate, and even more of a privilege to be having Stephen Ray and Judith Roddy and the wonderful Katrina McLaughlin directing it and working with us. And we start rehearsals next Monday, and we launch that today. So it's a really exciting time for the gate to feel that we are now back.
Well, we look forward to hearing, to seeing and hearing that, and to hearing what else is going to come in the months ahead. Selena, thanks for speaking to us this evening. And The Visiting Hour by Frank McGuinness, as Selena Cartman was telling us there, will stream at the Gate Theatre on the 22nd, the 23rd and the 25th of April. And you can find out full details on gatetheatre.ie. Later this week will mark the 80th anniversary of the death of writer Virginia Woolf, who died by suicide on the 20th of March in 1941 at the age of 59. She was one of the most important modernist writers of the 20th century and a pioneer of the stream of consciousness form. Her innovative work captured the fast-changing world in which she was working, exploring transformations in gender roles, sexuality and class. She's best known for classic novels like The Waves, To the Lighthouse, Orlando and Mrs. Dalloway. But her essays on literary history, artistic theory and women's writing have also had a major influence, including, of course, the seminal text A Room of One's Own, which addressed the status of women, and more particularly, women artists. As well as writing, she was a publisher and a key member of the so-called Bloomsbury set of artists, writers and intellectuals. I'm joined this evening by critic John Self to talk about the life and work of Virginia Woolf. John, you say that Virginia Woolf is perhaps more talked about than she is read these days. So before we talk about the work, tell us a little bit about who she was, the kind of world that she came from and lived in. A world of privilege.
Yeah, a world of privilege, certainly, Sean. You know, she grew up in a wealthy family, although what she did experience was that her brothers were privately educated, went to Oxford. She wasn't allowed to do that. This was still the early 20th century, whenever women didn't have the vote and so on. So she did experience a lot of difference there. But she was from a privileged background, and she certainly experienced a much sort of smoother, frictionless rise in her life than most people around her did. But she was very aware of that as well. You know, in her diaries in 100 years ago, in 1921, she was talking about the troubles in Ireland and how she felt cocooned away from it. And so she was privileged, but she was aware of her privilege.
And the educational advantages that came to some of the men in her family did not come her way.
No, that's right. That's right. And she, you mentioned A Room of One's Own in the introduction, and she wrote about that and gave a talk about that in 1929. And what she said was that if she invented this fictional sister for Shakespeare called Judith Shakespeare, and she said that if she had existed, she wouldn't have been able to do what Shakespeare did in terms of writing all the plays and the success, because the women just didn't have the opportunities. She would have been off in the home, doing the housework and things like that. So she was a pioneering feminist in that sense.
In the particulars of her writing, I mentioned this idea that she was a modernist, an innovator when it came to form, and I suppose the stream of consciousness was particularly important in Virginia Woolf and in her writing. What do you think she was trying to achieve in that new expression, or that new way of that new form that she explored?
Yeah, well, what she was trying to do, I suppose, is what all writers have tried to do from the start of time, which is to represent life as it really is experienced by all of us. And she felt that she could do that by paying more attention perhaps to the small things than to the big things, by thinking about how we think about life, our thoughts go, you know, so a stream of consciousness or like an eddy of consciousness, you know, things go back, our minds float back and forward. She was, the word she used was free. She wanted her books to be free, you know, free of the encumbrances and expectations of fiction. Now, of course, some of the expectations of fiction, like having a plot, are very welcome, you know, and make the books easy to read. And, you know, so her books do require a little bit of work, but I think they give great pleasure and reward in return for the work.
You say that Mrs. Dalloway, however, is a great starting point. It probably is in terms of form. Is it easier to get to follow than some of the other writings?
Yeah, it is. And she kind of continued to push the envelope as she worked. So Mrs. Dalloway was kind of like, there was a transitional novel called Jacob's Room. And then she wrote Mrs. Dalloway, which was her first sort of fully modernist novel. But it's still pretty easy to follow. And actually, there's an interesting scene near the start where there's an aeroplane passing overhead and it sort of drags the viewpoint of the book from character to character. It was a very interesting way of doing it. But after that, she wrote, you know, To the Lighthouse and The Waves. And by the time she got to The Waves, you know, she was sort of telling the entire story of people's lives purely through dialogue. And it's a very sort of impressionistic thing. You know, there's no real plot or story at all.
And Mrs. Dalloway, then, we're looking at this woman's day, another modernist writer from this part of the world.
Indeed, in the same month as well. It was one day in June for Mrs. Dalloway, a different year. But a woman preparing for a party, essentially, during the time of the Spanish flu and all the things that go through her mind and the memories. And then it compares her life with the life of another character called Septimus, who was suffering from I suppose they called it shell shock then, or post-traumatic stress disorder from the war. So it was, again, you know, experiencing or being aware of the privilege, but also living the privilege.
Yeah, and obviously we think of Joyce and Ulysses and the one day that's involved there for two characters, I suppose, in some ways, both Bloom and Stephen Dedalus. What comparisons do you make there, or what comparisons, probably more importantly, did she make between herself and Joyce? Did she recognise his work, or did she refer to it in any way?
She did. I mean, interestingly, they were almost exact contemporaries. You know, she was born about a week before Joyce. She died about 2 months after him. So they were, you know, they lived exactly the same time. They were doing exactly the same things, or trying to do the same things. She liked Dubliners. She was a little bit less persuaded about Ulysses. Her great friend T.S. Eliot was constantly trying to persuade her of Ulysses' greatness. She did say that she thought it had, genius, but she, and this is where we come to, I suppose, to the privilege and the snobbery inherent in her, which was that she considered that it was illiterate, underbred, the book of a self-taught working man, and we all know how distressing they are, she said. It was like a queasy undergraduate scratching his pimples, you know. So she obviously felt herself socially to be a cut above Joyce, and maybe she felt that came through in the work as well.
Yeah, we get a sense of that. I have a recording of her. I think it's believed that there's only one voice recording of Virginia Woolf that survives, made on the 29th of April 1937 when she was 55. Part of a BBC radio series called Words Fail Me, Virginia Woolf read an essay called Craftsmanship. The beginning and the end of the recording are lost, but here's a section from the middle of that essay.
Do we write better? Do we read better than we read and wrote 400 years ago, when we were unlectured, uncriticised, untaught? Is our modern Georgian literature a patch on the Elizabethan? Well, where are we to lay the blame? Not on our professors, not on our reviewers, not on our writers, but on words. It is words that are to blame. They are the wildest, freest, most irresponsible, most unteachable of all things. Of course, you can catch them and sort them and place them in alphabetical order in dictionaries, but words do not live in dictionaries. They live in the mind. If you want proof of this, consider how often, in moments of emotion, when we most need words, we find none. Yet there is the dictionary. There at our disposal are some 500,000 words, all in alphabetical order. But can we use them? No, because words do not live in dictionaries, they live in the mind.
So, I'm just thinking, I was listening to Virginia Woolf there, John Self. I know it's a recording from 1937. I know it's the BBC. So there's a certain delivery that we might associate with that time, that period, and that particular organisation. But the superiority, I think, or the sense of superiority, is there in the sound. But when you actually listen to what she's saying, It's quite down to earth, to be fair to the woman.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I mean, she makes the Queen of England sound common in that recording, but she you know, in her diaries, if you read her diaries, she was very much interested in everyday life, you know, and in what was happening, as I said, in other parts of the world. And she was, you know, I suppose you could say that she couldn't have written about how people think and in books that are still read 100 years later if she didn't have that down-to-earth quality and understanding of what real life's like. And, you know, she 100 years ago, actually, she wrote in her diary about 1921 about conversations she had had about how none of her or her contemporaries would be read in 100 years' time, and she was wrong about that.
And in terms then of, you know, we get the sense in the accent as well, but the world that she lived in, the Bloomsbury set, her husband Leonard Woolf, and she had a long affair with Vita Sackville-West. In fact, letters about between her and Vita Sackville-West quite recently published.
Yes.
That Bloomsbury set, how would you characterise that set of people, John?
Well, this was a group of, I mean, at the core, there were about 10 of them. It was people like E.M. Forster, you know, John Maynard Keynes, Virginia's sister, Vanessa Bell, the artist, and others. And they were, you know, I suppose, forward-thinking, anti-bourgeois values. They wanted to find new ways of doing things. I think, you know, looking back on them, and maybe because they've become such a turn of phrase, they almost seem quite cliquish and cosy and maybe inward-looking, especially when you think of all the sort of the war and Spanish flu and financial crises that were going on around them, that they were to some extent sheltered from. I mean, you mentioned Vita Sackville-West and Virginia's relationship with her. And, of course, Virginia wrote a book called Orlando, which was inspired by Vita and her relationship with her. That was quite a forward-looking book as well in terms of sexuality.
Yeah, because there's quite a gender fluidity across the book, and it moves across time with total ease in the way only a modernist writer could.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, that's one, I mean, it was written around the same time as To the Lighthouse, late 1920s, but it's not of the same type. It's a much more straightforward book. So, you know, again, maybe that's the entry level rather than Mrs. Dalloway, and that it's a much more playful book, much more straightforward. Fun, you know, it's about a person who changed sex or gender, lived for 300 years. I mean, what could be more fun and interesting than that?
We can't not mention A Room of One's Own, the seminal text. How important is that in terms of, I suppose, in terms of feminist thought? It was hugely important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mentioned the Shakespeare sister concept that she wrote about earlier, but also she said in A Room of One's Own that what a woman needs to be able to write fiction is £500 a year in a room of one's own. So you've got time to think and independence of spirit and mind. And in fact, she herself, although she was from a privileged family, she wasn't hugely rich once her parents died. And it wasn't until she became sort of the mid-1920s that she started to be able to finance herself and stop relying on her husband. She had that £500 a year from her own writing.
And sadly dogged by depression and mental illness throughout her life right to the very end.
Yes, unfortunately. And she, as we said at the outset, she took her own life when she felt another wave of mental illness coming on, and that she just felt she wasn't going to survive. And it was, but you know, her she was famous even then, and her death was headline news. It was on the BBC that evening's news and so on.
Well, yeah, as you say, maybe we should go to the writing, not talk so much about her, but talk about her writing instead. So thanks for being with us this evening. That's John Self speaking to us about Virginia Woolf, who the 80th anniversary of her death will be on the 28th of March. Oh, yes, just news coming into us about the Rathbones Folio Prize. The winner has just been announced, Carmen Machado for In the Dream House. Carmen will be talking to us soon on the programme here. Among the shortlist for the Rathbones Folio Prize this year were Elaine Feeney for her novel As You Were, and Erin the Grafer for A Ghost in the Throat, and Sarah Baum's Handiwork. But congratulations to Carmen Machado, and we will be speaking to her, as I said, later on the programme. Not tonight, but in the coming week. The Picture of Dorian Gray is Oscar Wilde's only novel, a Faustian tale of a young man obsessed with his own beauty, whose narcissistic drive to remain eternally desirable ultimately leads to his downfall. The story has been adapted on many occasions for film, television, radio and theatre, and it has now been adapted. Well, I don't know what you would say. They say it's a stage production. To me, it looks like something else. A group of theatres in the UK have come together to reimagine the Dorian Gray story for precisely this age that we are living through right now. The production will be available to view online up until March the 31st. Helen Meaney has taken a look at it for us here on Arena. Speak to her in a moment. But the play does have a stellar cast, including some voices that you will instantly recognise in this clip.
I suppose my first question is, Why do you want to speak publicly about what happened?
Yes, of course. Look, Dorian was a very special person to me. And what happened to him... it was just tragic. People say there's no dark side to social media, that there can't be a dark side to a digit. They're the same imbeciles who say guns don't kill people. But it is killing people, and it has to stop.
So where should we start?
Let us start with two best friends.
There are two kinds of people worth knowing in this world, Grey. Those who know absolutely everything and those who know absolutely nothing.
Which am I?
Who says you're worth knowing?
The Shade.
Just kidding. You can be worth knowing by association. Isn't that right, Bella?
He's so sharp, isn't he? Sharper than I could ever hope to be. I remember he was over for supper one evening, and I trotted out that Oscar Wilde, "I can resist everything except temptation" line. I thought I was being hysterically refined. He came back with, "The only way to get rid of temptation is to yield to it."
Joanna Lumley at the end of that clip there. Indeed, you heard her at the beginning as well as Lady Narber. You also heard Stephen Fry as the interviewer, Fionn Whitehead as Dorian Gray, Alfred Enoch as Harry Wotton. And this from a new production of The Picture of Dorian Gray, available to us online. Helen Meaney, as I said, has been watching it for us. The story of Dorian Gray itself, this young man who gets the present of the portrait, he stays forever young and beautiful. The portrait grows boils and horrible things up in the attic. How is that transferred by this group of theatre companies for the age we live in today, Helen, in this retelling?
Well, it's sort of reversed very cleverly in that Dorian's image is preserved digitally by his friend Basil. And so he remains online in his online projection, if you like, eternally beautiful and youthful. And it is his real, his offline self, who we see over the course of the film, just becoming kind of pockmarked and disfigured, and his face is blackened, and he's so that it's the reverse. It's the picture, the online picture, and he is sort of going into decline. And the way it's done is that we're watching all this through different screens and multimedia projections, and the whole film is constructed and edited using recordings on YouTube and you know Instagram, TikTok, Zoom, CCTV. It's just screen upon screen, and everything is mediated and then further mediated.
Quite
a complicated structure.
But when you're watching it, you can follow it. The complication is there in the attempt to describe, I suppose, rather than in the actual watching of it itself. But it really is looking at this whole idea of the selfie in lots of ways, and how you can put whatever filter you want on yourself to look whatever way you want, and you can look very different and an awful lot better than you might look in reality. That's what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, I mean, it's taking that to an extreme, obviously, the kind of digital enhancement of our self-image that we all have access to. But this is through a kind of a software developer has done this specifically for Dorian. So it's exactly making it completely relevant to all of us who are now, you know, constantly immersed in this digital world, but it's taking it the Wilde's moral fable and sort of flipping it. And there's a lot of things that are really clever and kind of knowing about this production. It's set right up at the moment during lockdown. So Dorian is a student, English literature student, at the beginning, and he's actually in his hall of residence, little room, making his very first video, and so it's all about the fact that he's isolated, and we're all separate, and that's kind of in that world that the virus is incorporated really into the structure. This whole idea about his images and his videos going viral. And then by the end of the film, he's got 500,000 followers and he's an influencer. And it takes us into all sorts of the dark side of the web.
Fionn Whitehead plays the character of Dorian. Let's listen to him well before he has the millions or the hundreds of thousands of listeners. This is his first post on his YouTube channel.
Hi, Welcome to my channel. My name's Dorian, second year English. I know what you're thinking. What do you do with a BA in English? Just a little musical theatre joke for you there. You're welcome. So it looks like this shit show is going on till at least the end of the term. So I just wondered if we might be able to help each other out. I'm on Bell Jar and Kite Runner at the moment. Nice cheery reading list for a pandemic. Anyone got Emma? Anyway, hit me up. Maybe we can do YouTube lives or something and just make sure we're not all heading for an epic fail. I know. Nothing worth knowing can be taught, but I figured we should at least try. Check back on here and I'll try and think of some other things to talk about.
Christ, is that the first thing you ever posted? I had forgotten that one.
Okay. Be safe. Wear your fucking masks. Bye.
And there you go, getting you're told to wear your masks within that clip from the picture of Dorian Gray, the production that Helen Meaney is speaking to us about this evening. A group of English theatres come together and giving us this online version. Fionn Whitehead playing the character of Dorian there. And we heard just at the end, Alfred Enoch as the character of Harry Wotton. I mean, I mentioned Stephen Fry as the interviewer and Joanna Lumley as Lady Narber. Like, this is a serious high calibre cast. But the casting of Dorian Gray, we expect him to be this beautiful, extraordinary, handsome, you know, beguiling young man. Did Fionn Whitehead give you that?
It's subtle in that we see him grow into his confidence, his physical confidence, his sort of sexual confidence. So in the beginning, as we just heard there, he's quite gauche. And he's a very delicate face. He's very sort of androgynous. He's, you know, people around him, men and women, find him really attractive, and he realizes this, and then he starts really manipulating that, and manipulating particularly his two friends Harry and Basil. So we see him change an awful lot over the course of the film, and it's all through you know, close-ups on his face. And you know, it's a brilliant performance, really riveting, because we have to see how he becomes more and more sort of self-involved and egotistical and callous and cruel. And in a way, that's all, you know, that's all has to be conveyed in his face.
The other thing is obviously this has been made during lockdown when actors can't be in the same room as each other. And they've been very clever about how they do that, because every actor is doing his or her piece to camera in a separate place. So nobody actually had to be in the same room together at any one time. But how does that work for us as the viewer? Do we get a sense of connection between the people? Do we get a sense of the emotional journeys that they're going through?
We do. I mean, it's all in the editing. The amount of post-production on this must have been just phenomenal. So it's brilliantly shot, and then it's all intercut and spliced, and it's one screen looking at another, people looking at flashback of other recordings. You know, there's so many layers to the filming. There's also CCTV. The Stephen Fry character is, you know, speaking on Skype, doing his interviews. So, you know, it's like a hall of mirrors. But because of the close-up way it's shot, we do get a strong sense of emotion. There's a character who is very briefly and disastrously Dorian's girlfriend, called Sybil Vane. And she is superb, and she's recording herself on Instagram. She's an aspiring actress, and she's recording her speeches from Shakespeare. And anyway, Dorian rejects her in a really cruel way, and then she makes a final video on, you know, so she's actually having a breakdown, and then she commits suicide. And this is all happening close up on our screens. We don't see her killing herself, but we see her just before that.
We know what's
so it's
happening.
Almost like playing out every single aspect and moment of your life
worth
with these
seeing,
young people. She's only 18.
Worth seeing, you're saying, for sure, Helen.
Oh yeah, technically really fascinating, and some great performances. It's intriguing, and it's extremely sophisticated and slick, highly polished. It's very clever. Yeah, I'd recommend it.
All right, that's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available to stream right now. It will be online until March the 31st. Tickets are £12. And when you buy a ticket, you have 8 hours from the initial time of the ticket's validity to watch the production as many times as you want. Pictureofdoriangray.com will give you all of the details there. But that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Paddy Carney was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.